So, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I am here in Grantahead headquarters.
Is that in our pirate recording studio?
In the pirate recording studio of Granta, sitting here this afternoon with Ted Hodgkinson, who is a writer, but also the online editor of Granta. Now, just two shelves down, there are something like 300 copies of the latest, or what is going just about to be released, Granta 119, which is the Britain issue. And it's an incredibly, I mean, seeing them all stacked up next to each other, it sort of really gives you a full-on patriotic punch to the eyeballs.
Well, yeah, I mean, when you have the spines lined up, the Union Jacks do rack together like that. I think that the cover, once you get beyond the red, white and blue, there is this nuance to it, the subtlety to it, with there's a teacup, co-designed with Paul Smith, by Michael Salu, our artistic director, and the cup's slightly chipped, and there's a suggestion there that things aren't exactly chipper as they might be, and that patriotic fever you're describing isn't all it might seem at first. You know, the Union Jack and the teacup, you know, are on the cover, but I think there's a pretty stiff drink inside.
Yeah, and it is an interesting juxtaposition, those two together. And we're going to be actually delving and rubbing, if that's the term, the sort of underbelly of...
We're going to be rubbing in the basement?
I was thinking, oh, don't go there, but I couldn't, you know, I had to get from rub to underbelly somehow. So anyway, we're going to be, we're going to be doing something with the underbelly of that issue with a fantastic story by Mark Haddon, which you're going to be reading from and talking about. Is there anything you'd like to say about the story before we actually delve?
I think that this story touches on a particular kind of British childhood, but also the way that children can find themselves in these new moral universes that they kind of create for themselves, where anything can suddenly seem possible and violence can suddenly erupt, and suddenly you're very far away from the adult world and its safeties. Mm. Yeah, those are some of the reasons.
Great. Well, I'm really looking forward to reading it and also seeing kind of how that resonates for you, because you did have a British childhood. I didn't have a British childhood because I was born and bred in South Africa. So it's going to be curious to kind of see the different aspects that are kind of brought out for us in the reading of this. Okay. Please.
The Gun by Mark Haddon. Daniel stands in the funnel, a narrow path between two high brick walls that join the playground to the estate proper. On windy days, the air is forced through here, then spun upwards in a vortex above the square of so-called grass between the four blocks of flats. Anything that isn't nailed down becomes airborne. Washing, litter, dust. Grown men have been knocked off their feet. A while back, there was a story going around about a flying cat. Except there's no wind this morning. There hasn't been any wind for days, just an unremitting mugginess that makes you want to open a window until you remember that you're outside. Mid-August. A week since the family holiday in Magaluf, where he learned backstroke and was stung by a jellyfish. A week till school begins again. He is 10 years old. Back at home, his older sister is playing teacher, and his younger brother is playing pupil again. Helen is 12, Paul 7. She has a blackboard and a little box of chalks in 8 colours, and when Paul misbehaves, she smacks him hard on the leg. His mother is doing a bit of big jigsaw of Venice on the dining table, while the tank heats for the weekly wash. He can see the white legs of a girl on the swings, appearing, disappearing, appearing, disappearing. It is 1972. Silver Machine and Rocket Man. He cannot remember ever having been this bored before. He bats a wasp away from his face as a car door slams lazily in the distance, then steps into the shadow of the stairwell and starts climbing towards Sean's front door. There will be three other extraordinary events in his life. He will sit at dusk on the terrace of a rented house near Cahors with his 8-year-old son and see a barn on the far side of the valley destroyed by lightning, the crack of white light appearing to come not from the sky but to burst from the ground beneath the building. He will have a meeting with the manager of a bespoke ironworks near Stroud, whose factory occupies one of three units built into the side of a high railway cutting. Halfway through the meeting, a cow will fall through the roof, and it won't be anything near as funny as it sounds. On the morning of his 50th birthday, his mother will call and say that she needs to see him. She will seem calm and give no explanation, and despite the fact that there is a large party planned for the afternoon, he will get into the car and drive straight to Leicester, only to find that the ambulance has already taken his mother's body away. Only later, talking to his father, will he realise that he received the phone call half an hour after the stroke which killed her. Today will be different, not simply shocking, but one of those moments when time itself seems to fork and fracture, and you look back and realise that if things had happened only slightly differently, you would be leading one of those other ghost lives that sped away into the dark.
Thank you. So straight away, it seems like we're in a very specific time and place, aren't we?
Very much so. I think he's able to capture the weight of things in this. I mean, literally, in that opening paragraph about the actual weight of them, so that you know what, how hard the wind is blowing to lift them off the ground. And I think that he's fantastic at locating his characters in the things and the objects that kind of are the constellation of their life, if you like. So from LPs like Silver Machine and Rocket Man, and even the eight chalks, multicoloured chalks in the box, so beautifully specific. And I think it really locates you very much in the quiddity, if you like, the thisness of these people's lives, these characters' lives.
It does, and it feels very concrete. And then, but it's also shot through. There's just little glinting lines, aren't there, of almost kind of just pure poetry. I'm thinking about this particular line: he can see the white legs of a girl on the swings, appearing, disappearing, appearing, disappearing. It's almost a moment of cinema or something. That's you suddenly get in the middle of this fairly realistic description of a place.
Absolutely, and I think that the point about cinema is absolutely right, because I think often he distills an image down and freezes it almost so that it's almost static. And some of these sentences, I hope it came across in the reading, are essentially nouns that just have full stops. Washing, litter, dust. And that's a sentence. And as you say, there's movement in that, but it's also beautifully sort of held and contained. I think, and that sentence you point out as well, of the girl's legs appearing, disappearing, appearing, disappearing. And that seems to me to both be happening in time and also frozen in time. So that there's a sense that the place that we're being introduced to has always been like this and always will be. And that's, I think, what's really unnerving and extraordinary about those three flash forwards that we get into his different lives, where he's able to locate the significant moment in this character's life, the three significant moments, and really each of them the third one is less so, I suppose, but the first one involves a house being destroyed by lightning, the second a cow falling through a ceiling, the third is utterly heartbreaking and really quite unsettling.
Chilling, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
As well, yes.
And yet there's still that thinginess about it, that he drove to Leicester and it was half an hour later, and everything has its measurement. So yeah, I think it comes straight through his prose. You get the actual measurements of a life without it ever falling back into some kind of statistic.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you say everything has its measurement apart from boredom. Because, of course, boredom is the one thing that is sort of unspooling without measure.
Yeah, that's a lovely point. Yeah, I think absolutely. And I think we'll see as the story goes on that that's one of the wonderful contradictions of his writing, is that there's this wonderful precision to the prose often, and yet this completely unwieldy life that happens around it, so that you feel as though this very neat observational register is just being completely blown apart by the fact that these people live messy lives, and they don't they're not going to abide by this, by these measurements. So yeah, I think that's a pretty central, I think that lovely sentence in the second paragraph, his mother is doing a big jigsaw on Venice on the dining table while the tank heats for the weekly wash, and it's like those are the two elements that we're talking about. There's that sense of her kind of whiling away the hours, and she is fascinated by jigsaws, and we find out later on, but there is an element of, you know, procrastination or boredom in that, you know, even if you're fascinated by jigsaws, they are a way of like
soaking up time.
And then the weekly, what the tank kind of clicking away.
Well, let's continue reading then, shall we?
Okay. Sean is not a friend as such, but they play together because they are in the same class at school. Sean's family live on the top floor of Orchard Tower, whereas Daniel's family lives in a semi-detached house on the approach road. Daniel's mother says that Sean's family are a bad influence, but she also says that television will damage your eyes if you sit too close, and that you will die if you swim in the canal. And in any case, Daniel likes their volume, their expansiveness, their unpredictability, the China greyhounds on either side of the gas fire, Mr. Cobb's grey BMW, which he polishes and tea cuts lovingly on Saturday mornings. Sean's older brother, Dylan, works as a plasterer and carpenter, and they have a balcony which looks over the ring road to the woods and the car plant and the radio mast at Bargave, a view which excites Daniel more than anything he saw from the plane window between Luton and Palmer, because there is no glass, and you feel a thrilling shiver in the back of your knees as you lean over to look down. He steps out to lift and sees Sean's mother leaving the flat, which is another thing that makes Daniel envious, because when his own mother goes to the shops, he and Paul and Helen have to accompany her. Try and keep him out of trouble. Mrs. Cobb ruffles his hair and sweeps onwards. She is lighting a cigarette as the silver doors close over her. Sean's jumbled silhouette appears in the patterned glass of the front door and swings open. I've got something to show you. What? He beckons Daniel into Dylan's bedroom. You have to keep this a total secret. Daniel has never been in here before. Dylan has explicitly forbidden it, and Dylan can bench press 180 pounds. He steps off the avocado liner of the hall onto the swirly red carpet, the smell of cigarettes and brute aftershave. It feels like the bedroom of a dead person in a film, every object freighted with significance. Posters from Monty Python and the French Connection. Jimmy Doyle is the toughest. A motorbike cylinder head sits on a folded copy of the Daily Express, the leaking oil turning the newsprint waxy and transparent. There is a portable record player on the bedside table, the lid of the red leatherette box propped open, and the cream plastic arm crooked around the silver rod in the centre of the turntable. Machine head, thick as a brick, Ziggy Stardust. You have to promise. I promise. Because this is serious. I said. Sean tugs at the pine handle of the wardrobe, and the flimsy door comes free of the magnetic catch. On tiptoe, Sean takes down a powder blue shoebox from the top shelf and lays it on the khaki blanket before easing off the lid. The gun lies in the white tissue paper that must have come with the shoes. Sean lifts it easily from its rustling nest, and Daniel can see how light it is. Scuffed pigeon grey metal. The words Remington Rand stamped into the flank. Two cambered grips are screwed to either side of the handle, chocolate brown and cross-cut like snakeskin, for a better grip. Sean raises the gun at the end of his straightened arm and rotates slowly so that the barrel is pointing directly into Daniel's face. Bang, he says softly. Bang. Daniel's father works at the local pool, sometimes as a lifeguard, more often on reception. Daniel used to be proud of the fact that everyone knew who his father was, but he is now embarrassed by his visibility. His mother works part-time as a secretary for the county council. His father reads crime novels. His mother does jigsaws, which are stored between two sheets of plywood when the dining table is needed. Later in life, when he is describing his parents to friends and acquaintances, he will never find quite the right word. They aspired always to be average, to be unremarkable, to avoid making too much noise or taking up too much space. They disliked arguments and had little interest in the wider world, and if he is bored in their company during his regular visits, he will never use the word boring, because he is genuinely envious of their ability to make real joy in small things, and hugely grateful that they are not demonstrating any of the high-maintenance eccentricities of many of his friends' retired and aging parents. They walk across the living room, and Sean turns the key before shunting the big glass door to one side. They step into heat and traffic noise. There is a faint brown smog, as if the sky needs cleaning. Daniel can feel sweat running down the small of his back. Sean fixes the pistol on a Volvo travelling in one direction, then follows an Alfa Romeo going the other way. We could kill someone, and they'd never find out who did it. Daniel explains that the police would use the hole in the windscreen and the hole in the driver's body to work out exactly where the shot came from. Elementary, my dear Watson, says Sean. Let's go to the woods. Is the gun loaded? Of course it's loaded, says Sean. The woods rise up on the other side of the ring road, a swathe of no man's land between town and country. People park their cars at the picnic area by Pennington on the far side of the hill and walk their dogs among the oak and ash and rowan. But the roar of the dual carriageway and the syringes and the crushed lager cans dissuade most of them from coming down its northern flank.
Thank you. When you were reading that, when you got to that point where he's showing him the gun and he sort of, you know, whispers, or well, in your reading almost whispers this the exclamatory bang, it did bring out the creepiness. I felt a real creepiness, the creepiness of Sean. I mean, is that how you experience him, as being a kind of creepy kid?
Definitely. I think Sean's someone certainly familiar for me. I think he's a kind of he's one down from a bully, I think, in the sense that he's not really big enough to be a bully. I think if he was big enough, he would be. He's more kind of dangerous in a way than a bully, because he kind of wants to be one. But he's quite wily, and he's quite clever, and he knows that he has power over Daniel. I think that's where he's most dangerous. And he knows that basically Daniel will do anything that he says. So there's a danger there, and I think that he has access to this hidden world. And I definitely remember, I was the oldest sibling, and I remember friends of mine with older siblings, and you do feel like they are gatekeepers to this other realm of possibility and you know, excitement and things that you know to be wrong from things that your parents have told you. which children with older siblings are less fazed by, and they're less shocked by. So I think, he's certainly he's a very mercurial kind of figure, Sean, but he's also quite familiar.
Yeah, I mean, he has the key, it would seem, in some way to adulthood, to some sort of experience of what it means to be an adult.
I also was thinking about what you were saying about boredom, and perhaps it's a very hard thing to define, but I do think that childhood is in many ways, mine certainly, a very magical time, and it's full of this possibility. And I think that one of the wonderful things that in the extract I just read was Daniel's appreciation for his parents and their ability to draw out the kind of wonder in the small, and which I think is what you were asking me about previously, about that, you know, boredom in childhood. And I think that there's a kind of almost, I think that in later life you kind of approach it through things like religion or music, or, you know, that sense of rapture in the small stuff, and people kind of get it in all kinds of different ways. And I think that it's something which Daniel is drawn to. And I think in a way there's a kind of Daniel's after a kind of peace, and he's excited by Sean's family. He's excited by their unpredictability, it says, and their kind of they're slightly outside of the boxness. At heart, I think he's after that that tranquility which exists in his parents. So I think that tension that exists between Sean and Daniel, it comes straight out of their home life. Sean embodies so many possibilities of inhabiting another person. It's almost like it's the first moment when he realizes what he is, and in that same moment he recognizes what he isn't, and what he wants, and what he lacks. And Sean absolutely is that. It's really interesting, that line about his father, who, you're right in the sense that he was or is sort of proud of his parents, but then there's that slight turn when he says,
he's
actually
become self-conscious, hasn't
he? He's become more self-conscious. His dad's a bit visible, you know, he doesn't want his dad to be so visible. And I think that, you know, that sense of his, where he comes from has gone underground, you know. And I think that's a very common thing to happen in adolescence. I mean, you kind of shun your roots and you want to sort of break out and be different, and so you go to you know, the most exciting characters, and sort of that you kind of run with the pack for a while, and that, and you do kind of feel as though life is boring, as he says, you know, he's never been so bored in his life. And I think that's a fairly universal situation, I imagine, I think. And then you and I think that's one of the things that energizes this story and makes it so kind of universal and strange, is the way that he's finding himself further and further out of his depth.
Now, I mentioned earlier that, you know, the sort of the culture, and this isn't, of course, a story in an edition which has the theme of Britain. And one thing that for me seems quite culturally specific is that the otherness and the excitement should reside in a gun, because my childhood was a South African childhood, and guns were plentiful. And guns, as children, we were not interested in guns, because every parent had a gun, and you'd seen guns and maybe even handled guns. And so for us, the equivalent of this would have been porn, for example, or something like that, you know, sort of girly mags, because that was absolutely censored and there was none of that about. So that was where the excitement was. And I suppose I'm just wondering, just in terms of your childhood, does this resonate in the sense that the otherness, the excitement, is in perhaps violence?
I remember being brought into, you know, a very Sean-like friend's house and being shown, you know, his older brother had a hunting knife, you know, and those kinds of things where you think, oh my God, that's pretty big, you know, that's a pretty serious knife that can really hurt someone. So, you know, there was, I think it was a Norwegian hunting knife, and I'm being quite shocked by that. I think if anyone had shown me a gun, I would have jumped out of my skin. It is a shocking image, and I mean, from a current affairs point of view, guns are on the rise, and you know, you hear more and more that there have been shootings in different parts. I come from Lincolnshire, and there's a lot of gun crime not so far away in Nottingham, and that does, so it does happen. But I think that there is still an air of extremity about guns that, you know, unless it's the sort of 12 ball you know, variety of guns, which are more common, I suppose, in the public mind, if you want. But we're not a nation of gun carriers, and we're not a nation of gun users, and
which will filter down, obviously, to children's perceptions of guns.
Yeah, and
as you say, seen as frightening things, and exciting things, perhaps, as well, because of frightening.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that there is a sense of, I mean, talking about it from a British point of view and what that symbol means in a British context, it's something quite striking that the image of a gun in this story can be so frightening. Because if you think about it from a movie point of view, or a television point of view, or really any kind of popular culture that comes from America, guns are absolutely ubiquitous. I mean, just as much as in South Africa, I imagine. And we're saturated with that, absolutely saturated with it. And so in many senses, from a televisual point of view, from a media point of view, we are taught that guns are everywhere. But in the context of this story, because it's so deeply grounded in that British context, I think that the appearance of a gun in a child's hands is quite frightening and quite unusual.
Mm. One line I wanted to ask you what you thought of, because I find it a sort of a strange line and a sort of a strange phrasing in a way. It's when he's walking into Daniel's room and he's talking about Dylan, and he says, it feels like the bedroom of a dead person in a film. And I thought, okay, I get the feels like the bedroom of a dead person, but a dead person in a film.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting, because it fits in with what we were just saying about televisual violence, I suppose, or media violence. And I think that that's probably because I think that's a line that's deeply inside Daniel's head. You know, that's Mark Haddon looking over Daniel's shoulder there and saying, this is the closest that he can imagine to this is someone from, you know, The Godfather, or someone from something that he's watched late at night when his dad's fallen asleep, or whatever, that he's clearly never seen a dead person, and he's never seen a dead person's room before, but he has seen a dead person's room in a film. And I think that is exactly to the point of the closest he's come to that kind of violence.
It's all this sort of twice removed thing, isn't it? So it's not only a dead person in a film, but it's a dead person's room in a film.
Yeah.
Let's continue reading then, shall we?
They wait on the grass verge, the warm shock of waves passing lorries, thumping them and sucking at their clothes. Go, shouts Sean, and they sprint to the central reservation, vaulting the scratchy S-shaped barrier, pausing on the ribbon of balding grass, then running across the second carriageway to the gritty lay-by with its moraine of shattered furniture and black rubbish bags ripped open by rats and foxes. All that bacteria cooking slowly. An upturned pram. they unhook the clanky gate where the rutted track begins. Sean has the gun in a yellow Gola bag thrown over his shoulder. They pass the scrapyard with its corrugated iron castellations. They pass Robert's house. A horseshoe box with a flat tyre, a floodlight roped on a telegraph pole. Robert hails and Robert hails and Robert hails. Grandfather, father and son. All bearing the same name and all living under the same roof. The youngest Robert hails is 2 years above them at school. He has a biscuity, unwashed smell and bones that look slightly too big for his skin. He used to come in with small animals in a cake tin, stag beetle, mouse, grass snake. But Donny Farr grabbed the last of these and used it to chase other children around the playground before whipping its head against one of the goalposts. Robert pushed Donny to the ground, took hold of his fingers and on his left hand and bent them backwards until two of them snapped. The curtains in Robert's house are closed, however, and there is no red van parked outside. They walk on towards the corner where the path narrows and turns into the trees. Slabs of dusty sunlight are neatly stacked between the branches. If it weren't for the smell of exhaust fumes, you could imagine that the roar of traffic was a great cataract pouring into a ravine on your left. They find a clearing that contains the last few broken branches of a den they built earlier in the summer, where they drank Tizer and smoked 4 menthol cigarettes, which Sean had stolen from his mother's handbag. Let's do it here. Sean finds a log to use as a shooting gallery and sends Daniel off in search of targets. He climbs the boundary fence and searches along the hawthorn bushes which line the hard shoulder, coming back with 2 empty beer bottles, a battered plastic oil can, and a muddy teddy bear, with both arms missing. He feels exhausted by the heat. He imagines standing on the lawn at home, squeezing the end of the hose with his thumb and making rainbows in the cold falling water. He arranges the objects at regular intervals along the log. He thinks about the child who once owned the teddy bear and regrets having picked it up, but doesn't say anything. Sean raises the gun and moves his feet apart to brace himself. A deep cathedral quiet. The traffic stops. He can hear the shuttle of his own blood. He is not aware of the shot itself. The loose rattle of scattering birds. He sees Sean being thrown backwards, as if a big animal has charged and struck him in the centre of his chest mid-leap. The bear, the oil can, and the bottles are still standing. Oh my God! Sean gets to his feet. Oh my God! He begins dancing. He has clearly never done anything this exciting in his life. Oh my God! A military plane banks overhead. Daniel is both disappointed and relieved that he is not offered the second shot. Sean breathes deeply and theatrically. He braces himself again, wipes the sweat from his forehead with the arm of his t-shirt and raises the gun. The noise is breathtakingly loud. It seems obvious to Daniel that many, many people have heard it. What are you doing? It is the youngest Robert hails. They jump, both of them, but Sean recovers his composure quickest. What do you think we're doing? You've got a gun. Despite the heat, Robert is wearing a battered orange cagoule. Duh. Let me have a go. Yeah, right, says Sean. I want to go, says Robert. He steps forward. He is taller than Sean by a good 6 inches. Just as he did in the bedroom, Sean lifts his arm until the gun is pointing directly at Robert's face. No way, Jose. Daniel realizes that Sean may kill Robert. He is excited by this possibility. He will be a witness to a crime. People will respect him and feel sorry for him. Robert doesn't move. 5, maybe 10 seconds. The good, the bad, and the ugly. Daniel can't tell if he's terrified or utterly unafraid. Finally, Robert says, I'm going to kill you. Not in the way they say it to one another in the playground, but in the way you say, I'm going to the shop. He walks away without looking back. Sean aims at him till he vanishes. The two of them listen to the fading crunch of twigs and dry leaves under his trainers. Spastic. Sean lets his arm slump. Bloody spastic. He walks up to the teddy bear and places the barrel in the centre of its forehead. Daniel thinks how similar they look, the bear and Robert. Uninterested, staring straight ahead. But Sean can't be bothered to waste another bullet. Shit. Robert's appearance has made the adventure seem mundane. Sean throws the gun into the gola bag. Let's go.
Right, thank you. Now, I don't know how it was for you, but that part of the story where you suddenly have this eruption of kind of senseless violence with Donnie Farr, you know, smashing this grass snake's head against the goalposts, and then having two of his fingers snapped. I found myself really wincing at both of those events, but it's also that moment where suddenly the story sort of becomes quite exciting as well. You know, yeah. We get that sort of excitement.
Yeah.
We're no longer bored. Well, we weren't bored before. We were enjoying the sort of the languorous descriptions and the precision. But suddenly, you're really pulled in, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah. I think that's the moment when that's Donnie Farr's behaviour is the sort of first intimation of what's going to happen in the rest of the story, or what's the way that we're heading. When you're allowed to construct your own moral universe, where you're allowed to redraw those lines away from the kind of safety of adulthood, then the ground beneath your feet can really open up sometimes. And I think that that moment that you picked out of Donnie Farr killing the grass snake, it's one of those moments where you think, God, that is really horrific. I mean, that is, it's extremely Lord of the Flies, really, yeah. for a kid to do that, to, you know, take an animal that someone's kind of brought along as a pet, really, and to use it as a weapon. And I think using creatures and things as weapons is absolutely crucial in this story. And the way that at this point it's as though children are kind of arming themselves against adulthood, you know. And Sean's attitude is to get the gun, which is obviously, you know, a pretty you know, overt weapon, but there are all sorts of other kinds of weapons, and that they're sort of discovering, and which they don't even have any clue about themselves at this point. And you know, Daniel is so blithely accepting of Sean, so loyal, and he's very, very, I think he recognises you know, that he's in a similar situation, you know, if not to Robert, then the teddy bear, really. He's effectively, you know, without any say in what's happening here.
Suddenly, you have this question of, well, is it okay to use a snake? I mean, nobody's particularly fond of snakes, but to use a snake in that way. But equally, is it okay to have retribution and do something that violent for somebody who has killed the snake? You know, I mean, it suddenly brings up these quite, I think, quite a visceral, well, that's how I experience it, a very visceral feeling from the reader.
Yeah, me too. And I think it's absolutely that sense of, like, cause and effect. Like, who does Robert's action prompt Sean to put the gun to his head? No. But that's what Daniel's thinking. But I think, I don't want to give too much away about what happens later in the story, but that moral element, that visceral element, certainly comes out to the fore, because Sean's actions in his sort of aggression with the gun lead them into, a kind of a conundrum with, they've got themselves way in over their heads. And even just the action that I just read about, the kind of suggestion of violence, the gesture of shooting someone is a lot. I mean, I remember being told that you should never point a gun at someone's face. I mean,
even if it was unloaded,
or even if it was your fingers pretending to be a gun. Oh, you know, like, wow. That was considered to be you know, no go sort of thing to do. And maybe this is, again, maybe that's a British thing, I don't know, but there's you weren't supposed to do that. And I think because of the power that that symbol holds, and you're right, it creates a massive moral problem. You don't get any sense that Sean's like aiming in the same way that Daniel is for those kinds of soft moments of you know, I suppose you could kind of call it sort of just the poetics of the small stuff, you know, being at home and just enjoying being
at oneness home. As well, the oneness with his family and,
right, yeah, and exactly,
with the things around him, yeah.
Yeah, just you know, that the wonder in boredom, if you want, you know, like to join up the two things, try and join up the two things we've been talking about. And he experiences a lot of wonder, I think, Daniel does. And I think that Sean doesn't, and he kind of needs to get his kicks from something else. And maybe partly what Sean's annoyed, I think there's a slight sense of, you know, kind of annoyed by Daniel at some points, that he's kind of, you know, a bit of a drag, or he's slow, and like, get with the program, we are taking this gun and we're going to have some fun with it. And Daniel's always saying, why? I mean, what, I don't know, like, it's not right. And Sean is, you know, get with the times, you know, this is happening, get used to it. And I think that there's something very they have different ways, different access points, I think, to the things which drive them. And maybe Sean just hasn't found that that kind of locus to go back to.